Okay, we are in the middle of our first, well, we're at the very beginning of our walk through Genesis. We're going to teach through the whole book of Genesis. It's going to take us a long time. We're going to do it in 4 or 5 week chunks, take a break, talk about something else, pick up Genesis again where we left off. So we're in that first little chunk of Genesis, and we're in the creation story, and we're going to pick it up today. We're going to talk about, we're in Genesis chapter 1. We're going to talk about a couple of days of creation here. And just as we get going, just a reminder, Genesis, we've talked about this in the weeks leading up to today, but we talked about what Genesis is, and really what it is, it's a book of truth. It's a book that gives us a bunch of things. It gives us truth about who God is, gives us truth about who we are, who humans are, gives us truth about where everything came from. But it's truth in the form of a story. And Genesis is given to us in the form of a story. And a story is different than perhaps or a report, or it's different than a transcript or something like that. A story leaves gaps in things. A story is not a detailed analysis. And so when we're given this truth in the book of Genesis, and we talk about why it's truth, because we believe that God wrote it. We believe that God understood where everything came from. God understands about himself. God understands about us. And so God is telling us truth. We look at the Bible as truth, but it's in the form of a story. And so that helps us to understand as we're reading Genesis, all right, this is not, I'm not going to get every single detail here, because stories focus on people and events. You kind of move back and forth in time. Sometimes you zoom in, you zoom out. So as we read through Genesis, we have to be content with a level of unknowing. And we talked about that a while back, where there are certain things that are just mysterious. In fact, the very first week, we looked at two verses. In the beginning, God created the heavens and the earth. Clear, unambiguous, there's a God, and he made what we see. The next verse is filled with mystery. There was darkness over the face of the waters and the deep and this and that. We don't know anything. It's just filled with mystery that God doesn't explain to us. So as we read through this story of Genesis, we have to recognize, okay, God's telling us truth, but there's some stuff that he doesn't tell us. So we have to choose to be content with a level of unknowing, and that's really what faith is. Sometimes faith and truth, or faith and proof or something like that, we get confused a little bit. What faith is just belief alongside the unknowing. There's stuff we don't know. There is stuff we don't know, but we choose to believe something anyhow. And so that unknowing, I don't know all the details, but I believe anyhow. That's really what faith is. And so that's tied up into this. And so when we read Genesis, when we read the Word, and really when we study, when we dig into anything, it's good to remember this verse. We talked about this the very first week. It's Luke 10:21. It says this: "At that time, Jesus, full of joy through the Holy Spirit, said, 'I praise you, Father, Lord of heaven and earth, because you have hidden these things from the wise and learned and revealed them to little children. Yes, Father, for this was your good pleasure.'" I think what that means is that sometimes it's good for us to seek to know. We talked about that last week, how God created science. God gave us an intelligent mind, and he put us in a world that's filled with questions that we can seek out and search out. And God wants us to search and to learn and to know and to grow. And God, you know, science and study and learning, that's all very godly stuff. But it has to live in that level of unknowing as well. What I mean by that is a scientist has to be content with, there's some stuff I'm not going to know, just like a little child. Just like a little child. We can never become so wise and learned that we figure out everything in the world, because God chooses not to tell us. Instead, like a little child, I'm going to accept what God says. I'm going to search it out and learn as much as I can, but I'll get to a point where there's something I don't know. I'm going to choose to believe God anyhow. That's what it means, I think. Does that make sense? That's what I asked my kids to do when they were little. Daddy says this, we can talk about why. As you get older, you'll learn more about it. But for right now, you don't know everything, but you choose to accept anyhow. That's what we need to do, I think, as we're studying this and as we're letting God give us truth. Okay, so with that, and by the way, you can go back and listen to the messages that come before this if you would like to and fill in some of those blanks. All right, today we are going to bite off a little bit of a big mouthful. We're going to look at 2.5 days of creation. Mark teaches next week. He's only doing a half a day. I don't know how this happened, but we got 2.5 days of creation here today, folks. So here's what we're going to do. I'm going to read here verses 14 through 19 of Genesis chapter 1. This is day 4 of creation. So I'm going to read this. We're going to talk about it just a little bit. I'm in the New International Version if you want to follow along. And I'm going to start reading in verse 14 of chapter 1. This is what it says. And God said, let there be lights in the expanse of the sky to separate the day from the night, and let them serve as signs to mark seasons and days and years. And let them be lights in the expanse of the sky to give light on the earth. And it was so. God made two great lights, the greater light to govern the day and the lesser light to govern the night. He also made the stars. God set them in the expanse of the sky to give light on the earth, to govern the day and the night, and to separate light from darkness. And God saw that it was good. And there was evening and there was morning, the fourth day. All right, so this is the day where God is creating the lights in the sky. And we see these things, you know, the sun. God created the sun here. You can see it. There's sun out there now. And God made this thing. He created the moon. Last night there was, I don't know if it was a full moon or not. Did anyone go out last night? I woke up woke up in the middle of the night and I thought, why is it so bright coming through the window? And so I stuck my head out. I thought someone had left a light on out in the backyard, but it was just the moon. It was just so bright last night. And God created the stars. You know, you look up, when I was a boy, I grew up in northern Wisconsin, and it was a tiny little town. It was dark at night. There weren't lights. And so you could look up in the sky. I could see the Milky Way. I could see all of these stars. And you still can. It's a little harder here because of the light in the sky. But God created this stuff. There's going to be soon, isn't there going to be a lunar eclipse coming up very soon?
Blood moon.
A blood moon. Yeah. I don't know what that means, but it sounds fun. When is that eclipse going to be?
Tonight.
Go out and watch it. It's amazing because it's a chance for you to go out and look at this stuff that God created. There's the sun, and there's the moon, and there's the earth, and all of these things are going to line up here tonight in a certain way, and so it's going to look very different. So that's what God did. He created these lights in the sky on the fourth day. So let's just think about that a little bit. Let's spend a little bit of time just kind of processing that. One thing, as I read that passage, I think, well, one of the things God is doing is he is coordinating and managing his previous creation. On day one, God created the light. Today, on day four, he's collecting and consolidating and concentrating that light. Does that make sense? God created light, and there's light and darkness, and now he's gathering it together in the forms of these celestial bodies. And so he's taking light, and he's kind of concentrating it down. And I don't know what it was like before. This is one of those things of unknowing. We don't know what it was like for there to be light and dark before there was a sun. But that's something that God said happened. And so here we see him taking this light that he had created on day one, and he's consolidating it. He's concentrating it. He's putting it in smaller packages and putting it in different places. And that's the second thing he's doing. He's filling the expanse. On day two, God created this thing called the expanse, the sky, the heavens. What we see when we look up. The sun is up there in that expanse of the sky. The moon is there. The stars are in the expanse of the heavens that God created on day two. So here on day four, God is managing, if you will. He's taking stuff he's created in the first couple of days, and he is collecting it together. He is putting it in different forms. He's filling the expanses. He's He's kind of taking his creation and now moving it about a little bit, making it a little bit more orderly, filling the expanse of the sky, collecting and consolidating the light. One of the things that God says about this here that I like to stop and think about is that he says, let them serve as signs to mark seasons and days and years. We see here God creating the rhythms of time. And we know that time has rhythms. There's a day and a night. And there's a dark and a light involved in that. And it happens regularly. There are seasons, particularly where we live in. And we were just talking about how, you know, we missed spring. We didn't really. But we see the changes and we see what happens in the world around us, and these rhythms happen. And here, every year, we get the cold and the frost and things change. The world around us changes. And then spring comes and it warms up, and now the leaves are out and we're heading into summer. These things happen. They're rhythmic, and they happen at the same basic way all the time. The years go on. Year follows year. The earth moves around the sun. The moon moves around the earth. The stars up in the heaven. In the winter time, Orion comes up. The constellation Orion comes up, and you see him in the winter, but in the summer, he kind of disappears down there over the southern horizon. And these things happen regularly, and God created these rhythms, and he said he was going to do it. He did it on purpose. I'm going to put these things up in the heavens, and they're going to mark the seasons and the days and the years. And one of the things I think that I think about that is that's an environment that you and I live in and we thrive in. We are very rhythmic people. Doesn't mean you can dance, unfortunately. I wish that meant that all of us could dance, but we live in the rhythms of time. When it gets dark at night and it gets light in the morning, we're awake and we sleep, and we're awake and we sleep, and we thrive in that environment. We thrive in an environment where the temperatures change and the seasons come and go. We thrive in an environment where as the years go by, we grow, we learn. God's creating an environment that for you and I that we thrive in, and he created it here on the fourth day. These lights in the sky are going to move on a certain rhythm, and it's going to impact us. It's going to be something that we can thrive in. Now, it's interesting, if you want to spend some time really, really working on a hard thing to think about, ask yourself this. Is day four when time was created? Did time begin on day four? I don't know the answer to that. Because we can't imagine a time without time. We can't imagine that everything has to be there. There was a before and there's a what's coming. There's an after and there's a now. Everything we live in is that way. When did time begin? Did it begin before creation? I don't think so. Did it begin at the very beginning of creation? Maybe. I don't know. But it's an interesting question. And if you are a philosopher, some of you right now, and I know this, are thinking, well, who cares? It doesn't matter. But for philosophers, some of you are philosophers out there. Well, here you go. You go philosophize about that. Travis Walter and I are gonna he's nodding. We're gonna start a club at the Growler Guys, and we're going to smoke cigars and talk about theology together. So this is going to be our first topic. Is this where time created? I don't know, but God creates the rhythms of time. Here's a third thing I see in this passage. God created a universe for us to explore. God made a universe, and he asks us to explore it. He set the stage for science and learning, I think. Not just here, not just in this case, but we look up into the heavens, and we talked about this last week, how God gave us intelligence, and God gave us curiosity. And then he left a lot of answers unanswered. That is a formula for learning and science. There's a lot of stuff we don't know. When we see that, we have a natural curiosity that God gave us, and we have an intelligence to seek it out. I think here on day four, maybe as much as anywhere, God set the stage for science and learning. And all through history, it is remarkable to me how humans have been able to figure out stuff up in the heavens. Years and years ago, a fellow named Aristarchus, this is back in ancient Greece, long before the birth of Christ, long before any of the modern technology that we have, this guy named Aristarchus theorized what the size of the moon was. And we actually have, this is a picture of his, he wrote a book, and that's Greek. I can't read Greek, but that diagram is his mathematical understanding of figuring out the size of the moon. And here's how he did it. He looked at it at eclipses, and he figured, okay, I'm seeing here that the moon disappears. So what does that mean? Well, there's the moon is between the sun, and then the earth is between the moon and the sun. And so he saw that this was happening. And then Pythagoras, you all went to high school and studied calculus, you should know the Pythagorean theorem. It's a triangle. If you know two sides of a triangle and the angles, you can figure out the third side. He worked out the equations, and he figured out, okay, the moon has to be this big because of all the equations and where the moon and the sun and the earth all fit and the eclipses and all this stuff, and he was within decimals of how big the moon was. Amazing. This was a guy long before there was anything like a telescope. He's just looking up in the sky, and he's thinking, I think on day four, God put this thing in the expanse to mark the seasons and to stir our curiosity. And we've been studying it ever since, and that's good. All right, that's day four. We're going to jump now to day five. We're going to talk through day five and the first half of day six, and then we're going to draw some conclusions after that, okay? So we're going to move on to day five, and I'm going to combine it with the first half of day six. So I'm going to read now Genesis chapter 1. I'm going to read verses 20 through 25, and this is day five and the first half of day six of creation. Here we go. Verse 20, "And God said, let the water teem with living creatures, and let birds fly above the earth across the expanse of the sky. So God created the great creatures of the sea and every living and moving thing with which the water teems, according to their kinds, and every winged bird according to its kind. And God saw that it was good. God blessed them and said, be fruitful and increase in number and fill the water in the seas and let the birds increase on the earth. And there was evening and there was morning, the fifth day. And God said, let the land produce living creatures according to their kinds, livestock, creatures that move along the ground, and wild animals, each according to its kind. And it was so. God made the wild animals according to their kinds, the livestock according to their kinds, and all the creatures that move along the ground according to their kinds. And God saw that it was good." Okay. On day five and the first half of day six of creation, we see God creating a new kind of life. God is making a brand new kind of life. On day three, we talked about this last week, he created the plants and the vegetation, which is life, and it reproduces. At that time, that was a brand new thing. God created the plant life that reproduced. It was the first thing back then that was continuous. It was kind of happened again and again and again. Here, he's creating another kind of life, but it's a new kind of life. This is a kind of life that's different than the plants. The biggest thing here is the life that God is creating now has a brain, and it moves about. Plants are pretty much stationary. The tree grows there. The only time they move is when the tornado comes through your backyard and picks them up. But for the most part, the trees and the plants, they stay where they are. Now God is creating animals that can move about. There's some autonomy. They can decide, I'm going to go over there, I'm going to go over here, I'm going to do this or that, because now God is creating animals that have a brain. For the first time, that's a totally new thing. And we could talk for a long, long time about that. This whole idea that God made a creature that to some degree can think and can learn. My dog can learn. Cats can't at all, but dogs can learn. Most animals can learn. Cats can, they just don't want to. They just... yeah, that's right. They cats don't have to learn, they know it already. They don't know it. Oh, dear. I have cats. I like cats. But God made a brand new kind of life. A kind of life that can think and learn, and in some ways, decide and choose. That's a totally new thing. That's a totally new thing on the earth. Up to now, everything has been either, you know, rocks or fire or light or inanimate things, or it's a life that reproduces but doesn't think, doesn't learn. Now there's a life that moves and has a brain. We could spend a lot of time talking about that. For now, we're going to leave it there, that this was an amazing new thing that God did. The fact that there is an animal, be it a fish or a bird or a land animal, that its movements and its life force is directed by this central computer up in its head. And this computer takes in senses, it takes in information, it passes on information to the rest of its body. It makes decisions. I'm going to go there. And the brain then tells the feet what to do to get me from here to there. At the same time, the brain is telling the internal organs, you heart need to pump at this rate. You liver need to do this. You digestive system need to take this food, break it down, pass it into the bloodstream, get rid of the waste. This incredibly complex, unbelievably efficient organ inside an animal that takes in information, it learns, it decides, it governs. It's an animal with a brain. And because it has a brain, it can do things that nothing in creation so far has done. It can make certain choices. It can learn. It's an amazing thing. We could talk about that for a long time. We're going to leave it there. Another thing I see in this passage is that God is filling the spheres of creation here. He's filling them up. Kind of these different spheres of creation. If you remember a couple days ago in creation, God created the expanse. He separated the water from water and made the sky, this expanse. And then the next day, he separated the water from the dry land and he made the seas and the dry land. So there's kind of these three expanses or these three spheres of creation. Here God is filling them all with living things. The animals fill the water, the fish fill the water, the birds fill the sky, the animals fill the dry land. He's kind of filling the expanse. It's kind of what we said about the lights. God is taking his previous creation, and now he's filling it up with his new creation. This is the first time we see God bless something that he's created. It says here that he, where is it? God blessed them and said, be fruitful and increase in number. Fill the water and the seas. God blessed these creatures. And I wonder why. I suspect it has something to do with now these creatures can to some degree think and decide and learn. And so God is blessing them. There is some kind of a interaction here with God where he's choosing to bless them. Now this blessing, Mark next week is going to talk about the creation of man. It is very similar to how God blesses humans, but it's limited. It's a little bit different. God says to the fish and the birds, be fruitful, increase in number, fill the seas and the skies. Very similar to the language that he uses with humans at the second half of day six, but it stops short of what he says to humans. Do you remember what he adds to the blessing to humans, to Adam and Eve? Do you remember? What? Oh, come on, guys. I guess that's why we're going through Genesis. Yeah, he says that to the birds, too. Be fruitful in number. But he adds something to man.
Subdue the earth.
Rule over the fish of the sea and the birds of the air and all the animals that move along the ground. The first part of the blessing is exactly the same, but God adds to the blessing of man, and he limits it, and that's always worth noticing. If God gives something here but doesn't give it here, that means something. So we see that God is blessing these animals, but there's some kind of a limitation to it. He's giving them their place, their understanding where they fit in this. Here's the fourth thing I see when we talk about here day five and the first half of day six, where God is creating life, the life of animals. And this is what I see. And we're going to spend a little bit of time on this because I think it's important. Life is supernatural. We see here that life is supernatural. Let me explain what I mean by that. We've talked about that word supernatural up to now, and supernatural doesn't mean ghosts or it doesn't mean superheroes. It means that it's something that happens outside of the normal course of natural events. It's like things that happen that don't ordinarily happen in nature. It's supernatural. It's above nature. So it functions outside of the normal rules of nature, the normal rules of physics, or the normal rules of time, or all the natural things that happen to us. Supernatural just operates outside of that, above it. It's super. It's above nature. Life, the creation of life, is supernatural. Let me explain what I mean to that, and then I'll explain why that's important. So we're gonna chew on this just for a little bit together. There are two basic, in our world, and really for a long, long time, there have been two basic theories, two basic narratives of where life came from. And here they are. One comes from the Bible, and the Bible says that God envisioned and created life. God envisioned it, he thought about it, and then he made it. That's what we've been reading. The Bible says that God thought about life, and he spoke, and it was so. That's what we just read. So God thought about it, he envisioned it, somehow he structured it and fashioned it, and he spoke, and it happened. Or he created it. He planned it, he executed it, he created it. That's one. The second real theory or narrative about where life came from that you and I have grown up with, and really for the last 170 years, this has been the other one, the only real other one, is evolution. And this is my definition, and so it's not exact, and I realize we can talk about it, but I think this is close. Accidental chance and mutation repeated over billions of years. Life began when, as the worlds were forming, as our Earth was forming, life began when certain elements, be they proteins or be they atoms, be they elements that were not alive, combined in such a way, energy was added to it either through electricity or some form. It combined, energy was added, and it came alive. It happened, and then it happened again, and it happened again. And so these small life forms were accidentally happening, and that's really the right term. It was just random chance. So life was being created as just natural forces were accidentally bumping into each other. It happened again and again and again. Those life forms that got created began to mutate. So it was alive, and then it mutated. Something changed in that one. Those changes happened over billions of years, and each change, many of the changes, created a more complex being, so that the animals, the birds, the fish, you and I, all the life that we see began by this accidental chance and mutation repeated over billions of years. I realize I'm condensing a whole theory of evolution down into one incomplete sentence, but I think that's fair. Now, I've said that you and I, humans, have intelligence, and curiosity. And so we look at where did we come from and the question of, well, there's life. How did that get here? And that animal is different than that animal, and how did that happen? And those two animals look kind of the same. Well, what does that mean? Our curiosity and our intelligence will lead us to begin to search that out. And so both of these things, science or learning, and I'll use science here because science is the system of learning. It's discovering truth by creating or by performing experiments, gathering data, and analyzing that data. That's what science does. And so science has kind of looked at both of these things, or humans have looked at both of these things and said, well, gosh, which one is true? Or what can we learn about this? We want to learn, we want to know, so we have experimented. And we have looked and we have asked and we have sought out, well, how do I know which one of those is true? Well, let's learn as much as we can. Let's test it. Let's learn and know what we can. Now, I'm going to make a couple of comments here that are my understanding, so take them for what they are. They might be provocative, and that's okay. I mean them to be. You might disagree with them, and that's okay too. You don't have to take my word for it. You really, truly don't. But here's the first statement that I'm going to make. As science for the last 170 years has sought out really to prove or to evaluate evolution, I'm going to say this. Science has failed to validate evolution. And I'm dividing science and evolution here, and I'll get into that in a minute. But science, the systematic searching out of knowledge and truth, has failed to validate evolution. In many, many ways, I'm going to just talk about one, there are others, and you've maybe heard this. This is a quote here from Charles Darwin. Charles Darwin, if you've ever read Origin of the Species, has anyone ever read it? Origin of the Species? One. Good for you. Go to the head of the class. It's not a great read. But it says, one of the things that Darwin said, and Darwin was the one who first wrote systematically the understanding or the theory of evolution. He's kind of given credit as being the father of that theory. It was certainly thought about and talked about some before, but he collected it together and wrote Origin of the Species, and he's the first one to kind of systematically treat it in a very comprehensive way. He said this in Origin of the Species. He's talking about the fossils, looking at the fossils. And if it's true that their life form we're looking at now, a horse, say, if it's true that a horse evolved slowly by small mutations over billions of years, Darwin understands, well, we should be able to see fossils of all of the transitional forms. If the theory is that a horse began as a bird, and you've probably seen some of these charts where, you know, there's this bird-like creature that slowly evolves to a horse, and if you've seen the diagrams, there's all kinds of animals portrayed there. It went from this to that, to this, to that, to that, to that, and finally a horse. So if that's true, we should be able to find fossils of all of those animals in between the bird and the horse. Does that make sense? Do you understand what I'm saying? It happened over billions of years, millions of times. We should be able to see this. At Darwin's time, they weren't seeing that. And so Darwin said this in The Origin of the Species. Why then is not every geological formation and every stratum full of such intermediate links? Geology assuredly does not reveal any such finely graduated organic chain. And this, perhaps, is the most obvious and gravest objection which can be urged against my theory. The explanation lies, as I believe, in the extreme imperfection of the geological record. Here's what he's saying there. He's acknowledging, as a good scientist would, this is my theory. I think this is how life happened. But if that's true, here's something you should be able to see. what you should be able to see is all of these transitional forms. He's acknowledging here, I don't see them if they're not there. That's a problem with my theory. But he says here, he acknowledges, I think the reason we're not seeing them is we just haven't found them yet. That when he says the, I believe, in the extreme imperfection of the geological record, I think what he means there is that we just haven't found them. They're out there. We just need to look for them and find them. That was in 1859. Darwin wrote that. Now, 170 years later, that hasn't changed. There's a man named Stephen Gould. Many of you maybe have heard of Stephen Gould. He is, in our generation, the foremost apologist for evolution. And by apologist, I just mean he's the one who believes evolution is true and speaks about it and speaks in a way he tries to convince and prove and show people that evolution is true. He's written many, many books. He died in 2002, I believe. But he's in our generation, he was probably the foremost apologist for evolution. When it comes to this idea, just this one part of science looking at and evaluating evolution, he says this. This is from his book, Evolution's Erratic Pace. He wrote this in 1987. The extreme rarity of transitional forms in the fossil record persists as the trade secret of paleontology. The evolutionary trees that adorn our textbooks have data only at the tips and nodes of their branches. The rest is inference, however reasonable, not the evidence of fossils. We fancy ourselves as the only true students of life's history. Yet to preserve our favorite account of evolution by natural selection, we view our data as so bad that we never see the very process we profess to study. That's an interesting quote. He's being very honest. He's acknowledging what Darwin said is still true. We do not see that fossil record. We don't see it. So what evolutionists do as they seek to show, seek to prove, seek to flesh out, seek to validate the theory that life came from evolution, there are three things that they do, and you can read this. There's an article that you can read. It's called How Incomplete is the Fossil Record by a man named Robert Lamb. It's not long. It's an easy read. He acknowledges this as well. He says, all right, we're trying to fill in the gaps between the horse and the bird. We don't have the fossil records. He says, well, we have two other things that we can do. Number one is we can study the genetic DNA of all of the intermediate species. But there are none. And so he says what we do, and he says this. He says, scientists use a number of tools to reconstruct the tree of life. They depend heavily on cladistics, a method of hypothesizing relationships among organisms. Let me try to explain it. Cladistics is just a word. It means that they look for similarities in things and then hypothesize. So this next picture here is a cladistical example of how we got from, say, or this is not trying to say that the tortoise moved into a house cat. Instead, it's trying to say we look for similarities among things. In other words, if all of the animals that have four legs, well, they have a common characteristic. Okay, of all of the animals that have four legs, which ones have fur? Okay, now they have two common characteristics. Okay, of all the animals that have four legs and fur, which ones, you know, have a tail? Okay, now we have three common characteristics. And so they look for common characteristics among things. They find them, and then they theorize, well, maybe these all have a common ancestor. That's what cladistics is. Because they have some common characteristics, we are going to theorize that they have a common ancestor. Now, that is a fine theory, and it could be the case, But it's hypothesis, it's theory without any scientific proof. Again, there's nothing to study. It's a little bit like saying because a leaf and a frog are both green, they have a common ancestor. Well, we don't believe that, but it's a little bit like that. My point is this. And this is just the fossil record. If you go study about the idea of irreducible complexity, Darwin talks about that in Origin of the Species. He says the thought that an eye could gradually appear it just doesn't make any sense, because an eye won't work without all of the parts. Everything about an eye tells me that it showed up fully formed, but I don't believe that. I don't believe it, so I think we're going to find evidence that there are so many of these things. The point to this, the reason I'm saying this, is this. I'm trying to give you evidence of why I said science has failed to validate evolution. The systematic study has not backed up the theory. And yet, I'll say this, that there is a mammoth gap between what we see now and what is theorized. We do not see evolution happening now. We see adaption, and scientists are clear about this. No one has seen evolution where one species turned into another species. We have never observed it. Nor do we have evidence of it happening in the past. The fossil record is not there. All we have is a theory. And yet, the more we study, and the less evidence there is for it, some evolutionists still choose to believe in evolution. This is another quote from Stephen Gould. He's the guy that I had quoted earlier. And he says this: evolutionists have been clear about this distinction between fact and theory from the very beginning. If only because, and this is the part, we have always acknowledged how far we are from completely understanding the mechanisms or theory by which evolution, a fact, occurred. Stop and think about that for a minute. Now, I'm not trying to be funny. Think about this. What he's saying is that evolution is a fact, but we have no idea why. That's what he's saying. We don't understand the mechanism. We don't know how it happened. We can't explain how this thing happened, but we know for certain that it did. Evolution is a fact, but the theory of evolution is completely just a theory because we can't reproduce it. We don't have evidence to back it up. That, remember how at the very beginning, do you remember what I said faith was? Do you remember? Faith is belief alongside unknowing. This, what Stephen Gould says there, is faith. It's belief alongside unknowing. I believe in evolution, says Stephen Gould, though I cannot explain how it happened. That's exactly what he said. It is faith. It is not science. It is faith. It is choosing to believe something, though the science cannot validate it. Now, I'm not saying that that's wrong. I am not saying that that's wrong. That's what I do. I choose to believe, for different reasons, this book based on evidence, not on scientific proof. I cannot go back in time and recreate God creating the universe. I cannot do it. I choose to believe alongside unknowing. That's what evolutionists do. They choose to believe alongside immense, mammoth unknowing. So here's my second provocative statement. Evolution has ceased to be a science, and it has become a religion, just like Christianity. It's faith. It has ceased to be a science. Science has failed to validate it and has become a religion. So much so that many evolutionists now say, we can't prove evolution, so we believe that life came from another planet. It came in an asteroid or something. But all that's doing is kicking the can down the road. How did life form out there? We still don't know. Evolution has ceased to be science. It has become a religion. It's faith. And so here's where one place that we are left, folks. And I hope that you go home and think about this. You have to choose your faith. You and I have been put in a world where we have to choose our faith. And you can't choose both. That's my third provocative statement. You can't choose both. Either in the beginning, God created the heavens and the earth, or he didn't. He either created or he did not. I like this verse in Isaiah. He's talking about here, if you go read this in Isaiah 41, he's saying, I'm going to make streams in the desert. I'm going to plant trees where there were none. He's saying, I'm going to do things that don't make any sense naturally. I'm going to, because I can control the natural world. If you read here in Isaiah 41, that's what he's saying. I'm going to dry up rivers over here and form streams in the desert. And then he says in verse 20, so that people may see and know, may consider and understand that the hand of the Lord has done this, that the Holy One of Israel has created it. You see, you have to choose your faith. I would suggest to you that all that we see points to a creator. The complexity of the world around us, the complexity of your body cries out for a creator. If you look at, you drive home today, you're going to see tractors out in the fields plowing. If I told you that tractor just happened, over billions of years, that tractor, all those parts came together. It just happened. You would laugh at me. You would, and you should. It is mind-boggling to believe that your brain just happened. That a billion times more complex than that tractor. We would never think a tractor just formed out of a little chunk of iron over millions of years. And yet somehow we think, well, my body that heals itself, that reproduces, that thinks, that has emotion, a billion times more complicated. No, that had a creator. You choose what you believe. I believe in a creator. Because everything I see, everything reasonable, I'm not a scientist, I'm a lawyer. I look at evidence, I look at reason, I look at logic. Everything I see points to a creator, not a random chance. But you have to choose. Folks, you have to choose your faith. But be clear with yourself. Be honest with yourself. Evolution has ceased to be a science. It has become a religion. So what do you... And I say that because it requires faith. I'm going to believe this right alongside complete unknowing of how it happened. So what do you believe? What's your faith? And it makes a difference. Makes a difference who you believe. It makes a difference what faith, what you put your faith in. If God did not create, then sin doesn't mean anything. If God didn't create, then there is no sin because, well, if we're just a random chance, we can make the rules ourselves. And if I don't like that rule, I'll just change it. There's no consequence for my actions. And if God came later, if the world just happened and we were here and God came later and said, ha, I'm going to start making rules here, that's not fair. Who said you could make rules just because you took us over? Well, we hate Columbus for that. He came and took over and yet it makes a difference. It makes a difference who you believe. And I would say to you, Christian, think long and hard about this. Don't take my word for it. Don't take my word for it. But understand what's at stake here. You're choosing a God. You're choosing a God. Where did I come from? Where do I get meaning? Does God have any authority? What's my place and role in the world? Who you choose as your creator? Random chance? Or an intelligent, involved God? It changes your life. I would just beg you to consider this. We've been told all our life that evolution is a scientifically proven fact. It is absolutely false. That is a false, completely unsubstantiated statement. It's just absolutely not true. And in fact, all of the reason that I can see, all of the logic, everything I see points to a creator, but you got to choose. I hope and pray that you do. So what do we take from all of this? Really quickly, two takeaways that I see here. Two takeaways. Here's the first one. Creation is leading up to humans. Everything has been moving toward this idea of humans. It's God is creating a place and a role for us. He's creating a space for us to live, an environment that we will thrive in, and a role. Understand, learn, study, feel the unknowing to the degree that you can. Have a relationship with me. Learn to have a relationship with each other. God is creating a space and a role for us, and all of creation is leading up to it. It's kind of like this. When you were going to have your first baby, what did you do? Many of us, what we did is we made a nursery. This next picture here is just, hey, Tommy, can you give me that next picture? Here we go, it's coming. When you got a baby coming, you make a space for it, right? You get a crib, you get a little box of teddy bears there. When Sue was pregnant for about 2 days and I had bought my first teddy bear already. And you create a space in anticipation of this little one coming. That's what God is doing. He's creating a place for us. Now, I like to think of it more like this picture here. This is the place for me. There's a cow and a barn and a mountain to explore and a place to live. God created a world that is anticipating you. It's a place for you to live, an environment for you to thrive in, a world for you to understand. Things for you to do, things for you to manage. All of creation is leading up to what Mark is going to talk about next week. Here's the second thing I see here. And this isn't in this text. We need to go into the New Testament to see this. But we talked about that too, how the Bible helps. We really understand one part of the Bible by reading other parts of the Bible. And so here's the second thing I take away. Everything that God created, it's all going to be recreated. All will be recreated someday. Here in 1 Corinthians, I'll just read this, is starting in verse 38. It says, but God gives it a body as he has determined, and to each kind of seed he gives its own body. All flesh is not the same. Men have one kind of flesh, animals have another, birds another, and fish another. Sounds like what we just read, all these different life forms that God is creating. Plants and animals, they're all different. There are also heavenly bodies, and there are earthly bodies, but the splendor of the heavenly bodies is one kind, and the splendor of the earthly bodies is another. The sun has one kind of splendor, the moon another, and the stars another, and stars differ from star to star in splendor. So God is saying, all this stuff I created, it's all different. But then he says this, so will it be with the resurrection of the dead. The body that is sown is perishable, it is raised imperishable. It is sown in dishonor, it is raised in glory. It is sown in weakness, it is raised in power. It is sown a natural body, it is raised a spiritual body. All of this creation that we see, it's going to happen again. God will recreate you and I. See, we're going to get into in a couple weeks this whole idea of sin. And the whole point of Jesus and everything that happens from here on out in the Bible and all of Christianity deals with bringing us back to this place that God created us to be in the state God created us, wanted us to be in. But because of sin, he's going to have to recreate it. And someday he will. And I look forward to that. I don't know what that creation is going to look like, But you and I are going to be able to see that one if you have accepted Jesus. I think you and I are going to be in the middle of that one. And then we won't have to believe alongside unknowing, because I think we'll see. We'll watch it happen. And I look forward to that. Let's pray. Lord, I'm just thankful that you speak to us. I'm grateful for your word. I'm grateful for you, Father. I just pray that you would speak to each one of us now. Lord, we live in a world that has competing ideas. I choose to believe you, God. You've never given me reason not to. Everything I see points to you. Everything you've said, as I've followed it, it has strengthened my belief in you. I stand here today, Lord, and say, I believe that in the beginning you created the heavens and the earth. I believe you created me. And I believe that you know me, and I have a place and a role here. I believe that's true for all of us. Help us, Lord, to sort through this. In Jesus' name, amen. All right, we're going to take a 3-minute break.